Well, I'm going to begin with, suppose, a pretty impressionistic report from the demonstration yesterday. This is the 13th national demonstration, obviously in a very compacted time period. As I emphasized, this is very subjective. The organizers, from what I understand, just by looking at the Socialist Workers Party site, are claiming 200,000 people. Not my impression. Again, I don't know what other comrades who were on the demonstration think, but as I said, my impression was quite a lot smaller. Now, that might be because I was following the front of the demonstration all the way up to Piccadilly Circus, and then I went down, what's it called? Is it Piccadilly? Anyway, Piccadilly, I think it's called, towards Hyde Park. And I was the official photographer for the Weekly Worker, and my phone was, well, ran out of juice, so my sort of duties came to an end. With that, and other comrades had already distributed the Weekly Worker, I think, long before that. But maybe it was because the demonstration was held up by the small counter demonstration organized by the Zionists. Again, I spent quite a long time looking at them. There were, again, my guess would be a lot more than last time. I would guess a couple of hundred of them. They were behind barriers, and then we were behind barriers. So they were quite a long way off. There were individuals who got down. My impression was, the stewards did a good job of keeping us all moving. It was the stewards in the main that did that, not the police. But I got a bit bored, just looking at the Zionists in the distance, and eventually moved on. So it's quite conceivable that a section of the demonstration, stuck itself there. I certainly waited until the Jewish bloc arrived at that point and moved on. And then, as I said, I walked up Piccadilly, and other than sort of odds and sods coming, that seemed to be the end of it. So again, I don't know. And it's certainly true that the gathering point, which was Parliament Square, if people know it, quite a large area in front of the Houses of Parliament. And it's true that various contingents came from different directions. Nonetheless, Parliament Square itself, in terms of the beginning of it was very easy to walk about taking pictures. There were people playing music, people having their own particular, how should I put it, political sessions. Either way, I expressed my sort of skepticism at the 200,000. I haven't got a clue what the number would be. But as I said, subjectively, it was a lot smaller than the previous claims of 200, 300, let alone the 800,000 claim demonstrated. That was enormous. There was no doubt about that. Okay, I just wanted to come back to Gaza in a minute, but I thought I would also cover the Gideon Falter incident. This is this guy with the skull cap from the previous demonstration. Again, as the official Weekly Worker photographer, I was at the front of the demonstration. This time there was a sort of picket down a side road. I would guess, about 40 or 50 people. And this is where the Gideon Falter incident happened. The police sergeant, I'm not sure, was he a sergeant? Or anyway, the police guy in charge called him something along the lines of, "Well, you look openly Jewish." And that was enough to call for that was enough for the Tory press and sections of the Tory party to call for the resignation of Mark Rowley, who's the recently appointed a guy in charge of the Metropolitan Police. I didn't actually see that incident. And for the life of me, I wouldn't recognize this guy. He's the guy in charge of the campaign against anti-Semitism, which, to my memory, was established in 2015, I think, with more or less the sole purpose of trashing Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour left. I could be wrong about that, but that's my memory of it. But I did see an incident, which is actually on the front page, not of this week's Weekly Worker, but of the previous Weekly Worker, of two guys being detained and I think arrested. Initially, the response of the demonstration, which is quite healthy under these circumstances, is you rush to the defence of people who've been held by the police. So, for example, there's a guy who comes to these demonstrations dressed up as a press from Gaza, and he's got a riot shield. And the police actually detained him on the demonstration and let him go because precisely of the pressure of the demonstration, and then arrested him on the coach going home. So merely because they've let you go doesn't mean they still aren't out to get you. But the point would be, the point I'm trying to get to is that it turned out that these guys were actually part of the Zionist contingent. And I would say the Zionist provocation, along with Gideon Falter, who claimed on the radio when I first heard it, that I went to the synagogue and I wandered out. And I just wanted to go home. And there was this demonstration, I wanted to cross it. It was this policeman that stopped me. Well, I don't go to synagogue. And I have to confess, I haven't been to church for many years. But from my knowledge of people who do go to synagogues and do go to mosques and temples and churches, so they're not normally followed around by their own private film crew. They don't normally actually try to provoke people. And that's my understanding of it. As I said, I didn't see it, but I did see the picket. I did see two people held, one of who actually had a t-shirt on that said, "Arrest me." And so this week, again, no surprise. If you look at the mainstream media, and I include the TV and radio, let alone the press, what we had is equal coverage of this demonstration. However skeptical I am about the 200,000, it was certainly of many, many thousands of people, and the 13th national demonstration, which has included mobilization of 800,000, okay, claimed by the organizers. But the point that I would make here is that Gideon Falter's non-demonstration, i.e., he'd apparently called for a walk to nowhere, that they were going to gather somewhere, and he wouldn't announce to the police where this walk was going to end up. And so the cancellation of this walk because of security concerns and threats on the internet caused him to call it off. Well, my own, call me cynical, my own suspicion is that he never intended to call it. In Britain, organizers of demonstrations actually have to involve themselves, unfortunately, with quite rigorous negotiations with the police. And one thing that you can be certain of is if you went to the police and said, "We're having this demonstration, we haven't decided where it's going to stop," they would say, "Well, it's not on then, is it?" Either way, the point I'm really making here is that his non-walk gained equal coverage, as was surely intended, in terms of the media. We also had, again, on these non-story things, I was looking at the Times, I think it was on Saturday, and we had a story of someone called Romilly Blitz. Now, she's a Jewish young woman, a first-year student at UCL, University College London, studying politics and history. And she just returned from Israel, and she begins, her course in politics and history. And her description is that she was booed, persecuted, left nowhere to sit in the lecture theatre. I'm rather dubious on that. I mean, I don't know what lecture theatre it would be, but I doubt somehow that most lectures attract 400, 500 people and force students to sit at the back on the floor. Again, I don't know, but that's the story she was telling. And what was the intimidation she was suffering? Well, on the campus, there, people are organizing protest demonstrations and meetings and all the rest of it, along the lines of Free Palestine. And apparently our Romney found that intimidating. And of course, you'd already have guessed it, that this is an example of anti-Semitism. So what we get in the mainstream press, as well as the Zionists, of course, of the likes of the CAA and Gideon Falter, is the slogan, for example, "From the River to the Sea." This is a call for genocide against Jews. This is how it's being interpreted. Hence, you get the banning of what used to be called the Marxist Society from UCL. Now it's called, I think, I'm not sure what they would call it. Maybe it's the Revolutionary Communist Society, but it's Socialist Appeal. Why? Because they were calling for Intifada till victory. I think it's a bit of a silly slogan myself. Uprising until victory. Okay, we forgive them the hyperbole. Nonetheless, the fact that they actually got banned shows you the sort of creep that's going on. And that's why I've always warned comrades about falling back on, how she put it, dictionary definitions of anti-Semitism. I'm sure at the moment, if I looked up my Collins dictionary and I looked up anti-Semitism, I'd have a little trouble with it. It would be something like hatred or prejudice against Jewish people, something along those lines. But the fact of the matter is that we now live in an age, because dictionaries work on the basis of not what words have some intrinsic meaning, but common usage, is that clearly there's a shift going on. And there's a shift going on beyond the IHRA definition, along with all its 13, isn't it, examples, which includes giving it, if you call Israel a racist endeavor, that's an example of anti-Semitism. It's gone beyond that, clearly, in terms of the authorities in many British colleges, for the editors of newspapers, the editors of news programs, let alone the Tory party let alone the Zionists. It literally has gone to the point where anyone who criticizes the policy of the current government in Israel is going to be branded an anti-Semite. That's where the definition is going. Now, I don't know whether that will end up in a dictionary, but surely it must end up in a dictionary. Anyway, the point I'm making is that this campaign has been going on for some time. I think it began in America. It might have been applied in Germany, but clearly it's had a particular intensity in Britain with the Labour Party. But clearly it's spread way beyond the Labour Party now, and it involves mass demonstrations. And what's predictable, of course, about it is that hardly any journalists are allowed to, and maybe I don't know, maybe because they're just dishonest cads, I don't know, but no journalist seems to be in the business of actually questioning what is fast becoming common sense. You know, I don't know what it was like in America in the midst of McCarthyism, but my argument has always been, well, at least there was a Communist Party of the United States. At least there was a Soviet Union. The fact of the matter is that the anti-Semitism that what we're talking about is a big lie. Of course, there will be a few examples of genuine anti-Semitism that cannot be denied. And there's anti-Semitism on the left. We all know about the socialism of fools, the founders of anarchism, Proudhon and Bakunin. Yes, we know all about that. But in terms of the modern left, anti-Semitism, genuine anti-Semitism, is incredibly rare. Either way, this is the big stick, the big lie that they're hitting us with. And of course, what we get is the same weapon used in the United States. Predictable, isn't it? So yeah, I'm sure you all heard the same recording, or maybe there was film of it on TV. Speaker Johnson visiting Columbia University and denouncing this cancer of anti-Semitism that he says has now spread to 200 campuses in the United States. But of course, what that's really about is other students protesting in solidarity with Columbia students who started this camp, who were attacked by the New York police, and by all accounts were attacked with somewhat brutality. And that's resulted in a lot of academics, but above all students, expressing their solidarity by copying what the Columbia students were doing. I think it's only a matter of time before that happens in Britain too. The reports I've read, for example, show students in Paris also, reenacting, carrying out their own version of Columbia. And good thing too, because if we look at what's going on in Gaza, if they're accusing demonstrators on the streets of London for advocating genocide because they are calling for the cohabitation of Jews, Muslims, Christians, and people of no faith in one state, which isn't a slogan I would advocate, but nonetheless, I'm not advocating it because I think that what they're calling for is genocide. But if we are talking about genocide, it is being acted out on the Gaza Strip as we speak. Here are people denied clean drinking water, adequate food, adequate medicine, adequate shelter, and of course are being bombarded from the land and bombarded from the sky. And we have reports. I don't know how reliable, but we do have reports of the Netanyahu government being within a matter of days before they give the order to go ahead with their plans to assault Rafah, which has got what, 1 million, 1 million plus people crammed into it from the ground. But of course, you know, what we're talking about here won't just be the addition of tens of thousands of more deaths through direct means. What we're talking about is a population that clearly stands on the edge of a catastrophe because of disease. And that's what's in the offing. And all these American airdrops, you know, the building of this pier on the coast of Gaza, the extra lorries that are coming in, that is just a drop in the ocean compared with what is needed. So it doesn't surprise me, I'm sure it doesn't anyone here, that we've heard reports of mass graves in Rafah. I think there'll be many more mass graves. And that is an act of clearly of genocidal proportions because it's deliberate. This isn't the sort of, what do they call it, collateral damage, a euphemism for civilians being killed. This is a deliberate policy by the Israeli government, and it's built into the Zionist project. If you go to another people's land and you want to establish a work colony, what do you do with the natives? Either you must drive them out or you must kill them. And of course, what we've seen historically with Israel is driving people out. I don't know how Gaza will end. Will it end with people being forced out into the Sinai? I don't know. Will it end with tens and tens of thousands of deaths? I don't know. Does anyone know? But that clearly is something that's built in to the project of Israel. And it's why I think it's mistaken, as so much of the media does, the more liberal media in Britain, to talk about Netanyahu and his extreme right-wing government. It is an extreme right-wing government. But in reality, it's no different to Labour Zionism that was the dominant force with the foundation of Israel, which of course oversaw the first clear out of Palestinian masses in 47, 48. Okay, having mentioned genocide, it's also worth noting that there's talk at least of the International Criminal Court in The Hague coming out with some judgment on the question of genocide in a matter of days. Now, again, whether that's real or not, I don't know. But they were talking about the possibility of genocide, was it months ago? Surely it must have been months ago. And of course, what that would mean, and again, these are the press reports that I've read, is that Benjamin Netanyahu and other leading ministers in the Israeli government would be charged with complicity in genocide, to which, of course, they will put up the proverbial two fingers, because they ain't going to be arrested. They ain't going to be tried at some sort of rerun of Nuremberg or anything like that. We need to understand that international law in the main is either about, I don't know, fishing disputes, which both sides have agreed, you know, have some sort of arbitration, or it's the victor's justice. America is certainly not about to ensure that the present cabinet in Israel is hauled up anywhere. And Israel isn't about to be defeated militarily by anyone. Nevertheless, In terms of the court of public opinion, I think there's no doubt that after the initial shock of October the 7th, in terms of the West, public opinion has shifted massively against Israel. And precisely the point needs to be made again and again and again that that shift in public opinion includes public opinion amongst Jews in America and Jews in Britain. So, for example, I've already mentioned the Jewish bloc on the demonstration yesterday in London. It's also, again, just to reinforce the point, it's worthwhile making the point that we also had, again, as with almost every demonstration I've been on, the ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionist Jews lined up in all their rabbinical splendor with signs saying, genuine Jews oppose Zionism. What's the reaction from these hate marches, Suella Braverman? Is it to shout death to Yids or something along those lines? Of course not. Of course not. It's exactly the opposite. People flock to them to take pictures, flock to them to congratulate them. As long as you're not a woman, apparently, don't like being photographed with women. Nonetheless, of course, the crowds greet them and express their solidarity with them. Of course, they, because they're not anti-Semite, they are anti-Zionist marches. And even amongst Zionists, I would hazard a guess that what is going on in Gaza don't exactly make them comfortable with their own Zionism. I'm sure that's the case. Okay, let's move on. Thought I would turn to Scotland. I haven't been reading a great deal, but I've read enough because you can't avoid it to know that the First Minister, maybe his days as First Minister, are numbered. We know that there's been a break in the coalition between the Scottish National Party and the Greens in Scotland. Scotland has a PR system, so although they have the overwhelming number of MPs to Westminster, they don't have an absolute majority when it comes to elections to Holyrood, the Edinburgh Parliament. They rely on the support of the Greens, and there's been a falling out with the Greens. And apparently, this rift is now irreparable. The SNP government, as a result, announced backtracking on various so-called green targets. We have, I don't know, is it sort of slightly black comedy with Hamza Yousef going out to negotiate with Alex Salmond's ALBA party and its lone Scottish MP, MSP, Ash Regan, of course, was a rival of Yousef's in the leadership contest to become leader of the SNP and therefore First Minister. I don't know what the result will be. There's also talk of the possibility of an election in Scotland, because, as I say, I don't know what other combination you could imagine a Scottish government to take. I think it has to include the SNP. I can't imagine Labour going into coalition with the Tories, the Greens, and the Lib Dems and the ALBA party, for example. I simply don't know what the result will be, other than saying that it looks like very good news as far as Keir Starmer and the Labour Party in Scotland is concerned. Why? Because Scotland matters when it comes to Westminster seats, leave aside the government in Edinburgh itself. And one would expect the SNP to do badly, the Labour Party to do well. And therefore, with a boost in Scotland, we should expect to have an even bigger Labour Party majority in Westminster when the next general election is finally called. Of course, you know, what we have in the press is many a story of the wonderful or you know speaking skills of Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, their tactical wile, their strategic grasp of politics. And Poro Humza, he's a complete loser. I don't think it's really a question of that. I mean, from where I'm sitting down in London, it looked like the wheels were coming off the SNP wagon under Nicola Sturgeon. And that's before I heard anything about the financial scandal involving her, the treasurer, and her husband, former chief executive of the SNP. And he has now been not only arrested, but charged with embezzlement of funds. Who knows whether Nicola and others will be charged? So I understand it. That hasn't made a huge difference, if any difference, when it comes to people favouring independence in Scotland, which is roughly speaking still around about 50%. You know, it hovers down, this is my understanding, to 45%, hovers up over 50% sometimes. But we should understand that that doesn't directly map onto an SNP vote. And it certainly shouldn't be expected to map onto an SNP vote in terms of the forthcoming Westminster elections. In other words, people who will vote Labour can still favour an independent Scotland. But I would say this, that from my angle, I've sort of retained a deep scepticism for the sort of left-wing discourse that has got a deep, long history, that somehow Scottish independence is inevitable. I don't know when I first read it. Maybe it was in you know, the breakup of Britain, Tom Nairn's book, which I think had its origins in essays in New Left Review in the late 60s. And this became very fashionable. It was meant to complete the bourgeois revolution in Britain. Why? I don't know. Sort of. Apparently, it's because we've got a queen or a king, the House of Lords, that these are viewed as feudal leftovers. I think that's just nonsense. Britain has been a thoroughly bourgeois society for many a long year. I would certainly say for centuries. And I mean, looking at Europe, do we really think that Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, these are somehow backward societies compared with Republican, you know, I don't know, Greece or Republican Turkey? This isn't serious. But either way, this became a pretty powerful idea on the left. And what it meant in Britain, and I've certainly experienced this, is if you raise the question of getting rid of the House of Lords, if you raise the question of the abolition of the monarchy, along with a whole package of other radical Republican reforms, right? If you raise that, still on the left in Britain, many a sage will tell you, oh well, you're trapped in the idea of wanting to complete the bourgeois revolution. Don't you know that what Britain needs is socialism? I readily concur with the comrades. The question is, does socialism come exclusively or more or less exclusively out of the economic struggle for bread and butter issues, paying conditions, anti-trade union laws? Does it come out of that, or does it come out of economics? Yes, on the one side, but crucially, politics, making the working class not into an economic class, a class in itself that's always going to struggle, you know, even as individuals, you know, for less hours, more pay. That just comes with the nature of capitalist exploitation. But is the working class to become class conscious? Is it able to understand the politics of class? That's a different question. And that surely is the role of Marxism, not, you know, just rallying and urging on the economic struggle, but equipping the working class with the politics of class struggle, which necessarily involves how we are ruled. So, as well as raising the question of getting rid of the monarchy, not because it's a feudal relic, but because it's anti-democratic. Getting rid of the House of Lords, not because it's full of, you know, lords and ladies, you know, from the time of the Norman conquest. There's very few of them left. No, it's anti-democratic. Most of the people in the House of Lords are appointed. Most of them, I think, are appointed by the ruling government. No, we want to get rid of that on the basis of democracy, along with MI5, along with the standing army. We want a people's militia. We want PR, right? And the resulting democratic republic that we envisage, to quote Engels in his remarks about the Erfurt program, the democratic republic is the form of the dictatorship of the proletariat. This is the form that the working class can rule by. The working class cannot rule with a standing army. It cannot rule with a monarchy and a House of Lords. That's an absurdity. But the working class cannot rule unless it understands. Not only must it look after its own interests, it needs to understand that as well as the bourgeoisie, as well as the capitalist class in society, there is this thing called the middle class. What attitude does it have to that class? In the same way in Russia, but more so, unless the working class understood the politics of the peasantry, who made up the vast majority of the population in pre-revolutionary Russia, and for that matter, post-revolutionary Russia, it had no chance of being the hegemonic class. I'm not talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat, we're talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry, precisely for that reason. Anyway, the point I'm making is that I've never been convinced of this idea that raising constitutional demands had anything to do with completing the bourgeois revolution, or for that matter, that Scottish independence was somehow some inevitability, as was argued by Tom Nairn and many others on the left. It became a sort of common sense that all you needed to do is look at SNP votes, and it was somehow inbuilt into history that the breakup of Britain would happen. I've never been convinced that the ruling class would allow it, and I see no interest for the working class encouraging it, and quite the opposite indeed. When I see the left marching on demonstrations in Glasgow or Edinburgh, along with the SNP, under the slogan "Under one banner," I'm horrified. It will be the equivalent of us marching on demonstrations in London, along with sections of the Tory Party and the Liberal Democrats. Whoops, doesn't that remind me of the anti-Brexit campaign? Yes, it does remind me of that. It's the left losing any concept of class, any concept of working class independence, and therefore working class hegemony over these issues. The left constituting itself a tail to the bourgeoisie. And that's what's happened in Scotland. To some degree, that's what's happened in Wales. Okay, so what do we stand for? Going against our general approach, we stand in Britain for a federal republic. Why a federal republic? A federal republic would include the right to self-determination up to and including independence. Why self-determination? Why this federal arrangement? Simply because the Scottish national question is real. We haven't made it up. Go up there to Scotland. We haven't made it up in Wales. Go there to, Cardiff, Swansea, let alone to North Wales. You'll find out why we raise that slogan. But we raise it as a temporary measure. And indeed, I'd hope, that the future generations who actually realize a federal republic will not need to enact it. As a general approach, we prefer centralized republics, indeed, a centralized republic of Europe, a centralized republic of the world. That would be our approach. Okay. What else have we got? Oh, we have the resignation from the Tory party of one Dan Poulter, who was interviewed in The Observer. He's an ex-health minister, a MP for Central Suffolk and North Ipswich. He's also a mental health doctor, and anyone who's had anything to do with the NHS and mental health, let alone physical health, will know that this is the Cinderella of the NHS. And he is reported as saying, well, he still works occasionally as a doctor in the NHS and cannot look his colleagues straight in the eye because they know him as an MP and they know what's going on in the NHS because they're here, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, or whatever their particular shift pattern happens to be. Now, what we're told is that Dan is stepping down from being an MP at the next general election. So he's not going to trigger a by-election. I understand that. He's gone directly from the Tories to Labour. But we're also told, and again, this sort of gets maybe I'm just a cynic, I don't know, but it gets my do-do-do-do-do radar going. He's going to act as an advisor on health for the next Labour government. Now, given Wes Streeting and his remarks about privatisation and private companies, I'm not celebrating Dan shifting from one party to another. It doesn't mean that Dan is standing up for the principle, which is was the principle, should be the principle of the NHS, a socialist principle. You get treated on the basis of need. And if people need a mental, health nurse or doctor, need to, go into hospital, that ought to be what happens, as opposed to, well, there are no beds. Oh, come back in a month's time. There are no doctors available to see you. And maybe your GP in the meantime, hands you some depressant drugs or something along those lines. In other words, I'm maybe maybe unfairly suggesting that Dan might be looking for another career other than just being someone who works in the NHS. There are plenty of privatized and privatizing opportunities, but maybe that's being unfair. I hope so. Either way, what we have along with this defection is all sorts of Westminster rumours now going around about a summertime coup against Rishi Sunak and looking to promote Penny Mordaunt, who was a previous front runner in the race to, wasn't it, to replace Boris Johnson, if I remember right. She was one of the early front runners. Maybe it was Lynn Truss that won it, and then it was Rishi Sunak. Either way, she's in that sort of league. She's one of those that has allies, and she's being suggested by various Tories. I think that's just an illustration myself of desperate times. I think the chances of the Tories not getting a drubbing is fast going down the drain. I think they are in line for drubbing. On the other hand, how wrong can we be? I was rereading my book from 1993, In the Enemy Camp, and this was written after 1992, of course, and therefore with the advantage of hindsight. And of course, it talked about the 1992 election. This is when Neil Kinnock was leader of the Labour Party, way out in front when it came to the polls. And yet it was the Tories, it was John Major, the grey John Major, that won it for the Tories. So it's still not over, but that's how things look, at least from my angle. The Tories are in disarray, and the Labour Party, unless it sort of cocks up big time, is destined to form a government. Meanwhile, in the next few days, we have local elections, and this is the trigger that various Tories will be using to say that Rishi really has blown it, and therefore we need a new leader. Again, I'm no more in the loop than you are, but I just think it's worthwhile mentioning. Okay, so local elections, including in London for the mayor. I keep reading in the Evening Standard that our mayor, Sadiq Khan, what's her name? Susan Hill is catching up. I'm sure that Sadiq Khan actually is promoting these stories, because last time I bothered to look at this story, he was something like 25 percent points ahead. So maybe previously he was 26% ahead. Either way, yes. I mean, what he will be fighting is the likes of me, who shrug their shoulders and say, "Well, on Thursday, I'm not going to bother going out to vote for that shit." There will be a lot of us who take that view, and that will be a danger as far as he is concerned, and as far as a lot of Labourites are concerned, not out of apathy, but out of indignation of how close Keir Starmer is to the Tories when it comes to immigration, when it comes to Gaza, when it comes to Ukraine, from at least my angle, when it comes to the NHS and privatisation. You name it, what we have is triangulation in operation in all its ghastly glory. Either way, I would say that looking at the two papers of the left that I follow with particular closeness, other than the Weekly Worker, of course, i.e., the Socialist and Socialist Worker, on this occasion, I agree with the comrades in Spew. They're saying vote Tusk. I agree, trade union and socialist coalition. But they're also saying vote for the Workers' Party of Britain, George Galloway's party. And they were looking at the last debate in the House of Commons. Again, I don't watch, House of Commons TV, but apparently they're behind David Lammy and Keir Starmer in the debate. There were three MPs sat next to each other. One was called George Galloway, the other one was Claudia Webb, the other one is Jeremy Corbyn. And they were saying, wouldn't it be good in the next election, next general election, instead of just having three left-wing MPs, there was a whole group of left-wing MPs. I agree with them. And okay, we're not putting up candidates, but we would urge comrades on the left to vote for such candidates, of course, with criticism. I think the Tusk project is ridiculous. Labour Party Mark II. Why do we need a Labour Party Mark II when we got a Labour Party Mark I? Labour Party Mark I was damned awful. Why do we want to repeat history? And repeat history is farce, with every affiliate to Tusk having a veto. You couldn't make it up. Either way, I disagree with the comrades in the SWP who's saying, yeah, vote Tusk. Other than that, vote Labour. Yeah, but you know, with your fingers on your nose. But don't vote George Galloway and the Workers' Party. Why? Because what he's got is, when it comes to social issues, he and his candidates have got a lot of reactionary ideas. Well, I would still vote for them. In the same way, comrades in the SWP, I would have urged people on the left, including in the CPGB, to vote for respect candidates, including George Galloway, when you stood alongside George Galloway in the same party, when you were responsible when it came to respect conferences in voting down motions that we put forward, such as, for example, free movement. You voted that down. You voted down the idea that respect should commit itself to republicanism. You couldn't make it up. The SWP speaker said that would put off royalists. Of course, it would put off royalists. You voted down the right of a woman to have an abortion. And you substituted a woman's right to wear the veil. Well, I'm in favor of the right of a woman to wear the veil, but also I happen to be in favor of the right of a woman, whether she's Muslim, Christian, or an atheist, to terminate a pregnancy if she wishes. I just find the attitude of the SWP, what do you want to call it, hypocritical? Maybe they suffer from, is it short-term memory syndrome, long-term memory syndrome? Whatever it is, they seem to be suffering some sort of severe case of forgetfulness, and they ought to be reminded that they not only voted George Galloway, they stood on the same platform, the same manifesto as George Galloway. They even voted down, by the way, directly from what they stand for in Socialist Worker every week, that respect should stand for international socialism. They voted that down. So no self-criticism involved here, that we were wrong to be in this Popular Front party, that we were wrong to vote down these motions put forward by the comrades from the CPGB. The CPGB was responsible for upholding principles. We weren't. So what happened to the SWP in this bid? You cannot just blame it on John Rees. And if you blame it on John Rees, what you do is constitute yourself. You officially announce yourselves as sheep who don't have brains, who just carry out orders. Is that the sort of organization you are, comrades? So, yeah, we should vote left where you can. And of course, that involves, because we can, criticizing the candidates and the platforms of these organizations in our press, at meetings, not only in the local elections, but in the forthcoming general election too. Okay, I've got 6 minutes till I officially close, and I'm not going to take any longer than that, Bob. I just thought I would pick up on this talk by Rishi Sunak and Grant Shapps, the defense, so-called defense secretary, that they're putting Britain on a war footing. Well, it's true that what they're doing in the sort of fag end of the Tory government, they're wanting to make arms spending, war spending. They used to have ministers of war in Britain. That's a much more honest description, in my opinion. They want to make that an issue between the Tories and Labour. Will they succeed? No, because Keir Starmer is triangulating, and if they say They want to up spending on war. He's already said it. And so Keir Starmer and the Labour Party say they want a defence review, and they agree more needs to be spent. And indeed, they put a figure on it. And as far as I know, it's the same figure as Schatz and Rishi Sunak. But war footing, they're certainly trying to get the population into the mindset of where we have more guns and less butter. And I'm using that as a euphemism, of course I am. And so what we have is the completely risible suggestion from Sunak that this increased spending on guns will not involve any borrowing. It will not involve any extra taxes. Oh no, of course it won't. It's going to come from savings on, yeah, you already know it, on less civil servants. Well, it ain't going to happen, is it? You know, the more that they say things like that, the more civil servants they hire to administer these things, the more people they hire for the Ministry of Defence and all the rest of it. No, it's not going to happen. So this is a political question, but it's also a wider political question because there is talk, again, I don't take it seriously, of conscription. It's not that they're just about to introduce conscription, but they do want the population to get used to higher levels of arms spending and therefore less in the way of services, less in the way of spending on what we actually need. So the NHS, for example, will of course get an increase. We're getting older, our needs go up. But will it get an increase that measures against need? No, it won't. And so one excuse will be is, well, the most important thing is national survival. And apparently national survival is threatened by Russia, threatened by its potential victory in Ukraine. Why anyone thinks that Russia's just about to win in Ukraine is beyond me. And then China. Apparently China represents some sort of total threat. Whilst it does represent a threat in terms of global hegemony. Yes, capitalism is drifting towards war. There's no doubt about that. And they want to take us with them on that journey. And what I would say is that the social imperialists, those that do go on the streets of London and shout out, no making it up, I'm not making this one up, arm Ukraine should take ownership of what Rishi Sunak, David Lammy, and Keir Starmer are saying about so-called defence spending, arms spending. They're actually advocating more on guns, less on butter. That is the truth, even if you say it can be financed from more borrowing. If you want to do get into that, you still have to pay interest rates. Just a corrective on this. I just thought last night, because I know it's rubbish. At the moment, Britain spends something like 2% of GDP on so-called defense. So it meets the American. This is what Europe must spend. And as I said, the aim is from both main parties to go up to something like 2.5% war footing. Well, I just Googled Britain's war spending, World War II percentage of GDP. What did I get? Well, I didn't know the answer, but I guess roughly right. I thought to myself, roughly it's going to be 50% of GDP. It turns out that at the height of at the height of World War II, this is Wikipedia, it was 53%, and Britain was borrowing from America. It remained in debt, didn't it, until about a decade or two ago when it finally paid off the debt to the Americans. Either way, it's a fact worth knowing that Britain was the most highly militarized, highly mobilized society in World War II. It was more highly mobilized and militarized than the Soviet Union, more militarized than Germany, precisely because it had the empire, because it could borrow, and because it had the United States. So there were more people in the army, more of the economy was devoted to the war effort than any other country. That's my understanding of it. Either way, what I'm really trying to say is that's a war economy. What they're proposing is not a war economy, but that's what they want. Well, they're not wanting to go towards 53%. To do that, you need something like war socialism. No.